a quote from the poet Gregory Orr that I find delightful goes, "Bring me your chaos, and poetry says, I will give you my ordering principles." My name is Anna Fortner, and this is my poem titled, If Some Days After. To see it all was to collapse under my own weight, looking away as simple as turning off the radio or the television, resting my head against the window and closing my eyes. If some days after, I walked under a brightening sky, the clouds stacked into the cathedral walls, should I be forgiven for believing God delights in man? For ignoring what was behind me, humming its slow song, feasting on every heavy day I never had, every charge of sadness that fizzled into nothing, a placid momentum set for null infinity? Might I be redeemed by finally looking when that is what my young daughters, their questions, required of me? On days I bear the weight, one breath, one step at a time. It is the crow that calls from the absolute horizon. Yes, you are weak, she says. Yes, life is horrors, but also full of delights. Yes, you are strong. Yes, you can always stop and go another way. Yes, these are your answers. This poem, it's many things. First and foremost, it is an articulation of my most, might I say, prevalent weakness. And its history is long. I found fairly early in my adolescence that the suffering of the world was more than I could stand. And after being mired in that for a good long while, one of the coping mechanisms I chose, and I'm not at all proud of it, was to ignore the suffering. To quite literally not look at it, not read about it, to just keep it out of my head. And in practical terms, that really did mean turning off the radio or the television or closing my eyes. And it worked, but as I got older, into my 30s, it became clear to me that effectively sticking my head in the sand was taking its toll. That my ability to witness really any degree of suffering was absent. And interestingly, it's not my own suffering that I struggled with at all, really. It was everyone else's, but I think often it was concentrated around certainly the people I loved, their suffering, but also the suffering of the natural world. It was so fundamental to my upbringing, to my family's identity, to my own identity, that to imagine it being diminished or someday no longer there was overwhelming. And so even as I was spending tons of time in the natural world and, you know, coming to worship, I might even say worship it more and more, I was ignoring the ways in which it was being diminished, its absence being nearly guaranteed, maybe not in my lifetime, but those who come after me, certainly their lifetime. And so, well, you know, because I wasn't paying attention to these things, it sounds so benign, not paying attention to it, you know, it was a sin, I suppose, to put it in biblical terms, to give it some weight. Because I wasn't looking at these things, I was able to have, or I created what I hoped I was going to be able to create, which was transcendent moments of adventure and joy and love and connection. So much so that there were days that felt entirely sacred, and like I was myself a sacred being amongst other sacred beings, that man was something God should delight in, though I wouldn't have used those terms then. It's certainly the terms I would use now. And so a lot of this came to a head when I became a mother, and there was a kind of acuity to my awareness of the suffering in the world, and for some time, I think, acuity to my efforts to ignore it. But certainly becoming a mom has made me a better person, and it's wound about to this point I'm in now, at now, where I have to, in order to be a good mother to my daughters, I have to look at the suffering in the world, and I have to come up with my own coping mechanisms so that I can pass them on to them, so that they don't find themselves as unpracticed as I did. I speak to that sense of being unpracticed in the poem with this metaphor of a black hole. I love hunting for metaphors before I write a poem, and somewhat randomly found myself reading a book by Carlo Rovelli, who's a physicist, and actually was interviewed by Krista Tippett in an On Being episode titled The Conversational Nature of Reality. And I enjoyed that episode, and I don't know that I fully got at the time what that title meant, but what I understand now, and black holes are a great example of this, is that there are things in the world, there are realities in the world that we know exist because of the effect that they have on other things, not because we can see those things themselves. So a black hole is in conversation, so to speak, with the things around it. And because of that conversation, we know it exists. And that was such a delightful metaphor to me. I found myself researching more and more black holes. And one of the things that's fascinating about them is that they sing, certainly not at a level that humans can hear. It's so, so low. It's so slow, the tone, that it's not anything we could hear. I forget what it said, something like, if it's possible, 20 million years to reach us or something. But in the poem, that manifests as the line, for ignoring what was behind me, humming its slow song. So this idea that I was living my life with this black hole behind me that was humming its slow song, which is its own kind of siren song almost. It's alluring to just ignore the suffering in the world, but in the meantime, this black hole is getting bigger. It's feasting on these heavy days I'm not having, this sadness that doesn't fizzle into anything, no sense of action or effort to make the world a better place, and this sort of placid momentum, like I'll just coast through life because I have the privilege to do so. Um, And certainly now at 40 with a almost 5 and almost 7 year old, my hope is that I am redeeming myself in crafting answers to their questions about the suffering in the world. Most recently, I've been thinking a lot about and reading a lot about compassion. I do think it is the solution to the world's ills, and simultaneously, I don't see how this world, its people, will ever embrace compassion to the degree that would be necessary for us to persist. And that reality, when it hit me a couple of weeks ago, was definitely a kind of existential crisis for me to think, oh my God, there is the solution, and it's never gonna happen. On one of the days this existential crisis was its heaviest, I woke up super early and I went for a walk. And I was in near tears. And it wasn't like this sheer terror, or like there wasn't, it wasn't in, I don't know, it's like it wasn't fast. It wasn't like at the extreme end of the emotional spectrum. It was more like this heavy, slow sadness. You know, just this question of like, well, what is the point of life? Like, how do we make life worth living if humanity is surely on a path to its demise? And what does it mean to be a mother to 2 young children in the face of that reality? And so I'm walking and walking and walking, and then suddenly I become aware that there is a crow that is just cawing and cawing and cawing and cawing at me. And I had this sense of looking up and thinking, what? What do you want? And I registered the crow. It got quiet. But I was, because of that cawing, yanked out of myself. Not necessarily far enough out of myself to put those thoughts to rest, but they felt like they were made small by that crow. And so I kept walking. And I turned the corner, walking up this hill. And I looked to my right. And the crow, it's as if it's flown over to a tree near me. And I honestly don't know if it was the same crow. It sure felt like it was, because what it proceeded to do was caw and caw and caw and caw and caw at me. And it was so funny. I just was so struck by the humor of that moment. And I literally, standing on my own on the side of the road at probably 5:30 in the morning, just started laughing. And it felt like what the crow had done was kicked my butt into this like Buddhist headspace, which is to say, as I articulate in the poem, it felt like the crow was saying, yeah, you are super weak. You put your head in the sand forever. And yeah, life is a series of overwhelming horrors. Less so for you than most people, but nonetheless, a series of horrors. Way less than you, for you than most people. But, you know, it felt too like the crow was saying, but you're also super strong, and you can do this, and you can stop and go another way, which is actually really carefully chosen language, because it was one of the on-beings I was listening to, oh, I wish I remember who it was with, Krista says that one of the things she had learned and really was excited about is that redemption means, I think it's in Greek, means to stop and go another way. And I, goodness, that's a great definition for redemption. And it felt like that's what the crow was saying. Like, yeah, you screwed up and you can fix it and you can learn from what you did. And use it to be a better mother. This, that you are weak, that you are strong, that the world is full of horrors and full of delights, like those are the answers to the questions that your children are asking you and will continue to ask you. This poem is titled, If Some Days After. To see it all was to collapse under my own weight. Looking away, as simple as turning off the radio or the television, resting my head against the window, and closing my eyes. If some days after I walked under a brightening sky, the clouds stacked into cathedral walls, should I be forgiven for believing God delights in man? For ignoring what was behind me, humming its slow song, feasting on every heavy day I never had, every charge of sadness that fizzled into nothing, a placid momentum except for null infinity? Might I be redeemed by finally looking when that is what my young daughters, their questions, required of me? On days I bear the weight, one breath, one step at a time, it is the crow that calls from the absolute horizon. Yes, you are weak, she says. Yes, life is horrors, but also full of delights. Yes, you are strong. Yes, you can always stop and go another way. Yes, these are your answers.